Thank you very much, and thank you for coming tonight, and I hope you feel appreciated as we continue through the night. I want to share appreciation with everything that you're doing for Partners in Torah. So I'll start with my introduction, because I hate it when people introduce me, because then I feel like I have to sit there and listen to nice things, and I'd rather just, like, you know, it's like a hesped, and you have to listen to your own. It's embarrassing. So right now, I work for Nerla Elef, and basically I'm a Rebbetzin coach. Nerla Elef is a Kiruv training institute based in Israel that trains couples concurrent with and post-smicha, and then sends them out into the field all around the world to do Kiruv or Chinuch or community rabbanis. And my job is to follow up with the North American placements, the women in North America. So basically, that's kind of Rebbetzin coaching. I help them with transition issues and professional issues and how to give a class, where to find a resource, who's doing the same thing they're doing, what if they're lonely, what if their husbands are off saving the world, what if, you know, whatever's going on, you know, if they're in a faraway place, maybe they're not sure their eldest child is developmentally correct and they don't know who to ask because they're the Rebbetzin and they don't want to ask a congregant and, you know, they don't even know yet or whatever it is. So I help connect people with resources. So that's my Nerla Elef job. I live in Denver, Colorado, so I'm not more than 4 hours from any city in the, on the part of the continent that I take care of. I don't really go deep into Mexico, just Mexico City, a little bit into Canada, and then the rest of the country, skipping some states that other people have claims to. So, like for instance, my boss, who has a daughter in Florida, so I don't go to Florida. She does. And then in Denver, I'm a Torah teacher. I teach Torah to adults. And for all the organizations, I used to work for the Jewish Experience, and now I'm just a contract teacher. I'm their senior educator, and I teach for AISH, and I teach for Jewish Experience. I teach for VMH. I teach for Federation. I teach for whoever calls me to teach a class. And regular classes, I have a regular series in Sefer Chinuch right now and Bridging the Gap, which is a great Musar Sefer if anybody's looking for an English Musar Sefer. That's fabulous. That's hard to get. Rabbi Avi Fertig. It has a great Haskama from Rav Reuven Leuchter in it. He's a Talmud of his, and Shlomo Wolbe. It's an excellent book, and it's out of print. If you call him directly, he might send one to you. So you'll have to find somebody who has a copy and look it up inside. But it's really good. So I have a study circle on that. Avi Fertig, F-E-R-T-I-G. So it's bridging the gap of the Musar greats and today. So it's kind of like, I mean, in the book Shaarim B'Tfilah, by Rabbi Shimshon Pinkus. So he writes in the Hakdama, how do I come to write a book on tefillah? Like, who am I that I should write such a book? There's many greater people who've lived before me that wrote books. He said, all I am is a translator. I'm taking the earlier material and writing it in the language of today so that it could be absorbed today. That's what the gap that he's really bridging, Rabbi Fertig, is all the Musar greats, so the Musar is different today than it was then. The principles are the same, but how do you apply it? How do you live it? How do you work with it? How do you grow into it? That's what this book is. So it's really an excellent book. So I have a study circle on that, and I have my Sefer Chinuch, and those are my regulars, and then series is all kinds of classes around. So that's what I love to do. I love to teach and share, and I started out really professionally teaching and sharing through Partners in Torah. But I'll tell you how I got started as a Jewish teacher, really, just to tell you the story from a little further back, although I'm not going to tell you all the details, even though we just don't have all night. So I don't always tell everybody this, but I'll just tell you. So I converted at 16, and I moved to Israel by myself. I went to yeshiva in Israel for 2 years, and I wanted to be a rabbi. So on my way to Israel, I'm thinking, I'm going to be a rabbi. But it turns out once I got to Israel, it was more important for me to be Orthodox than to be a rabbi. So I couldn't. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to be a fabulous female scholar, you know, like some of the people that I met, you know, like a Rebbetzin Rina Tarshish type. And I figured I'm going to be her. I actually had my eyes on another woman at the time. I didn't know her. But when I told her husband, when I grow up, I want to be like your wife, he was like, forget it. You can't. And it takes generations to make somebody like my wife, and you're so fresh and so new, there's just no way you could ever catch up. Like, that can't be. And I saw that he was right. Like, the more I was there, the more I saw that you can't catch up like that. I could never be that. So finally I decided I'll be a midwife. And I applied to Hadassah Hospital. I knew. I didn't have that. I couldn't, right? I love teaching, but I wanted that. But I was 17, you know, so, and I read Rachela, A Woman of Israel, and it's a fascinating book also, Rachela, A Woman of Israel, actually with a Q. And it's a true story of a nurse in the Hadassah Hospital at the time of the beginning of the state and Hadassah and midwifery and what it was like and building the yeshuv. And I was very inspired, so I'd be her, right? So I was 17. So then I applied to Hadassah Hospital after I got my GED and completed a science preparatory program at Hebrew U. And I didn't get in because I hadn't served the country, so I joined the Army. So, and in the Army, I got a lot of pickup lines. Right, I had my three-quarter sleeves. I was exempted from the dress uniform because it was too short. And my long skirt, my three-quarter sleeves. And a lot of times guys would say, Ma datia? Gam ani hayti datia chayti betzava. You're religious? I was also religious until I went into the Army. So then I thought, you know what? Actually, I'll stay in the Army and I'll do chizuk. Like, I'll keep people religious in the Army. So then I was thinking I would do that. And so I saw there was clearly a need there. And then one day a soldier came up to me and said, oh, you're religious? I was also religious, so I was in the Army, and then he tried to impress me. He said, Ani lamadati masechet breshit, im harav shlita. And I thought, really? Masechet? I learned tractate Genesis with Rabbi Shlita. And I thought, tractate is Talmud. Genesis is five books of Torah. Shlita is a name that goes after the name of a rabbi. It can't be the name of a rabbi. It has to be Rabbi Shapiro Shlita. You know? So I realized he didn't even know enough to fake it to pick up a girl. And I knew more than him, which means I could teach, right? So it didn't mean I could be a generations deep, you know, scholar, but I could be a Jewish teacher. And that's really what I wanted to be. So it just took a while to shift the dream back to where I wanted to head. So I ended up coming back to America, long story, and getting married, married a lawyer, and moving to Long Island, having a bunch of kids, Kanainahara. Now I have three married and two at home and one in between, and an adopted Russian 23-year-old who lives with us, and two dogs. So we have a busy household still, married kids across the street with two grands. So, but anyway, so back in Long Beach, Long Island, I had lots of chavrusas on a regular basis. I wanted to continue my learning. The yeshiva that I went to was yeshivish, not seminary-ish, so it was very text-based. So I was busy learning and having chavrusas, and eventually I started to give a shiur. I went to shiurim, and I moved more into the right-wing world by learning from Tehila Yeager. She gave a shiur in Long Beach. And I had learned about the concept of shimush, and I wanted to be mishamesh chacham. I read a lot of biographies because I wanted to acculturate Jewishly. So even though I had been in Israel since 16, I really wanted to like imagine what it would be like to grow up Jewish. So I read a lot of biographies, which are mostly of men, right? Because there's not a lot of biographies of women. So I read a lot about the Chachamim and the sages, and I'd get so inspired, and I'd read it, and I'd think, I'm going to start having Tikkun Chatzot every single night. And then I'm like, wait, how about if I start with Shacharis every single morning? And then we'll move to Mincha. If I get that, how about Marv, and then maybe Tikkun Chatzot? But I would be so inspired. So I learned, I started driving to Hila Yeager back and forth so I could be Meshamesh her and have a Talmidah Chachama in my life that I could learn from. And through that, I moved more into the Haredi world. And I continued with my own learning, lots of books and tapes, gobbling them up. And I started to explain things to people as they came over. I had lots of different explanations for how things worked. And finally, one of the FFBs in the community said, you know, would you give us a class? Would you teach us? I said, I could never. I mean, 15 minutes away, we have Tehila Yeager and Esther Wien and Debbie Greenblatt. I'm like, no way. She said, please, that's 15 minutes away. We live here. We need a teacher here. We can't go 15 minutes away. So I said, I'd think about it. And that brings me to a story that I want to share because it was, for me, a very empowering story. So I wasn't sure. I was wavering. Who am I to teach Torah, especially in the face of such great women, really, in a class? It's one thing to learn one-on-one, but to really teach. So I read a story that, I mean, Hashem always gives you the right thing at the right time, right? So I was reading in one of my books a story of the Chavetz Chaim. So the Chavetz Chaim was the keynote speaker for the first Muetzet Gedolei HaTorah. And he got up that night as the kenes opened, and he spoke about the assimilation that was raging through Europe and how each one of the gedolim in the room had to take responsibility to go out there and stem the tide, that it just wasn't okay that so many people should be fleeing Yiddishkeit And all of these great people were learning but not giving. And he said, it's not okay. Everybody has to go and teach and try to stop what's going on in Europe today. We're hemorrhaging Jews. So that was his talk. The next morning, he hears everybody in the hallways talking about it. I couldn't possibly. Who am I? I'm not perfected enough. I'm not pure enough. I can't. My Torah is not it's not rarefied enough that I could possibly go out and tell other people they should keep Torah. My job is to learn, but not to go out and tell people they have to keep it. I can't do it. And that seemed to be the consensus among the Dolim there at that Moetzet. So he asked to speak again. And even though the schedule was packed, he's the Chavetz Chaim, so they let him. So he got up and he gave this mashal, this story. So there was a gvir who owned a nice part of a small town. And he would go to a few different towns. He would go and visit the towns that he had a stake in. And he went to one town, one of the hamon am there, one of the regular people recognized him and said, oh, come to my house, come have a cup of tea. I said, fine. He went and he had a cup of tea. And as he made the tea, he said, how much sugar would you like? 2 teaspoons. So he puts it in, he stirs it up. And he gives him the glass of tea. And he says, just wait for a minute until the sand settles to the bottom, and then you'll be able to drink the tea. So the gvir said, sand settles to the bottom? He said, yes, here in our town, the water is very sandy. So when we stir the sugar and it stirs the sand up to the top, we just have to wait until the sand settles, and then you can drink off the top of the glass. And he said, that's silly. Why don't you filter your water? And he showed him how to use a cheesecloth to pour the water through to filter it so it wouldn't be sandy tea in the first place. And he said, thank you very much, and the gvir left. And from then on, he filtered his water. A few months later, there was a huge fire in the town, and most of the town was destroyed. The gvir was away, but when he heard about the damage in the town, he came back to see what happened and survey the damage. And as he looked around, he was shocked at the devastation. And he said, I can't believe what happened. You have a volunteer fire brigade. What happened? Why didn't you put out the fire? And they said to him, you know, we were filtering the water as fast as we could, but we couldn't filter it fast enough to put out the fire. And he said, when the fires of assimilation are raging around you, you put out the fire with whatever you have. It doesn't have to be pure. So for me, it was very empowering. I felt like, okay, I don't have perfect Torah, and I'm not a perfect person, but there's a lot of people that have to learn, and the fires of assimilation are raging around us. I have to be there to put out the fires as best I can. Not just put out the fires, but help people to grow so that they can be empowered to put out the fires. I'm here to save the world. I don't have little plans. I want to help shape all of creation. And that's really the role of the Jew. Excuse me, the role of the Jew is to change everything. We're really one of my expressions I like to use is, we're the rennet in the cheese of the world, right? So you're close to Wisconsin. I was born in Wisconsin. So I like the cheese mushel, right? So imagine you have a vat of milk the size of this room. How much rennet do you need to turn it into cheese? Do you know? Not much. Maybe a half a cup? A statistically insignificant amount curdles the entire vat of milk and makes it so that it can be turned into cheese. That's who we are. Statistically, we don't exist on the planet. And yet, we're felt so powerfully because we are the catalyst of all humanity transforming the entire planet. That's what being a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh means. Mamlechet kohanim, we're all priests, each one of us. We're each a kohen. All of us, kohen Yisrael Levi, we're all kohanim. And who's our clergy then? I mean, we're the clergy. Who's our laity? What do you think? You can answer. Just join right in here. The laity are the umot ha'olam, the world. All humans are created in the image of God. All humans are destined, could accomplish olam haba. It's up to all of us to make choices that bring us there, and it's our job to lead the way. But before we as collective Jews can do that, we as individual Jews have a lot of repair work to be done, right? And that's the work of Partners in Torah, is to repair inside so that we can be shining to the outside. So I started with Partners in Torah. The first time I saw it in the newspaper, I thought, oh, that's so cool. I totally want to do that. I want to start with Kiruv this way. I was doing kind of Kiruv Krovim or deepening learning of people who are already committed. But how cool is that to actually get matched up with a Jew who is really curious and distant and really educate that way? So I read the article about it, and I saw, oh, it's 8 o'clock at the local Young Israel. It wasn't even our local one. It was a faraway one, maybe in Far Rockaway or something. And I thought, oh, I can't do that, though. I have 6 little kids, and there's no way I'm going out every week to make a commitment to 8 o'clock. Like, I can't do that. So I called them up. I was interested, and I told them that I really want to do this, but I can't commit to every week at 8 o'clock. But when somebody else, when another mother calls you up, a curious student calls you up and says, I want to do this, I want a teacher, but I can't commit to every week at 8 o'clock, I have little kids. So I said, match that mother with me. We'll get together on our own. So that's what happened a few months later. They called me up and had a match, Sally from Long Island. And I learned with her regularly every week. And sometimes I go to her house and sometimes she'd come to my house. One day, the kids got off the bus, bouncing off the yeshiva bus and in front of our house, and came inside, and they met Sally. And she looked different than, you know, a lot of the people that came to our house. So they asked me, who is that? Who is Sally? So I figure I'm going to try to make it, to explain the Tinok Shenishba concept to these young children, the concept of a kidnapped child, which is a halachic category. If somebody is kidnapped as a child, then they're not chayev in the mitzvahs in the same way that we're chayev, because they don't know them, right? So, and that's really what a secular Jew is today, is like a tinok shenishba. Even though they were raised in a Jewish family, they were raised by people who don't really understand. That's the halacha category that they fall into today. So I said that I learned with her. They said, do you get paid? I said, no, I volunteer. Why do you volunteer? And so I said, imagine what would happen if one of you siblings, chas v'shalom, was kidnapped and was taken away and raised by non-Jews and they wouldn't understand Torah. And all of you still were raised in our home and got to go to Jewish schools and you had a rich background in Torah. And then when you grow up, you'd meet your brother or your sister and you would say, ah, my long-lost brother or sister, come, let me teach you everything that you missed growing up in our parents' house. Let me fill you in on all the details. So that's what I'm trying to do. She's our sister. I'm trying to fill her in on all the details. So they looked at me and they said, you mean Sally was kidnapped? So I realized I had to back up a little bit and explain it in a little more simple way. But so she wasn't kidnapped, but right. So from that, so I learned with her one-on-one, and then I saw they were starting a telephone mentors program where you could learn by phone from your house. I thought, that's cool. I'm going to do that too. So I called up, and I became a telephone mentor. Meanwhile, for Sally, I had a rabbi who followed up with me regularly. He probably called me once a week in the beginning, answered tons of questions, really helped me navigate some more difficult waters. Like, for instance, why women don't have any control over a get, things like that, those types of questions, which I don't remember all the good answers, but he helped me in the moment. All kinds of different things. So, but we had lots of questions, too. This is a long time ago, so I don't remember exactly what we learned. But I remember that question came up. Why can't a woman give a get or demand a get? You know, how does that work? Why does the man only have control? And he helped me work through that. Then I became a telepartner. And I didn't get a follow-up phone call for 6 months. Not one. How is it going? Finally, 6 months later, somebody called me up and said, oh, you're a telepartner. How's it going? I said, it's going great. But that's only because I have experience. This is way too late for a first follow-up phone call. It's totally unacceptable. It's not okay that you're calling. Like, how are people supposed to do this? It's not okay. Now, it turns out I have a mother who's so supportive. And I was relishing to go back to Israel. I hadn't been back since I came back to the States. I always thought I'd go back. And then I'm Israeli now. I have Israeli citizenship. So at first there was an exit tax, which made it more expensive to go because I'd have to pay an exit tax to leave. Then they got rid of that. But then I had too many kids to go. You know, it didn't work out. And finally, there was this Kiruv training seminar, Mereshet, 1 week Kiruv training seminar for women from Chutzlar. It's at Neve. And I saw that and I was like, I have to go to Israel. I was dreaming at night of going to seminary. Like, I felt so real walking in the streets of Yerushalayim. I had to go back. So I called my mother. I asked my husband first if I could. He said, if I can get my mom to come, she came so that I could go for the week. So I had just gone. It was 1998. Went to that Mereshet Kiruv training seminar. And then I got this phone call after I came back. Right, so that's when I was chutzpahdik like that. I said, you know, it's just not okay. You have to follow up better. You have to support better people better if you want to have a program that works. She said, I know, we're understaffed. We don't have enough people. Got to know what to do. And I said, well, actually, I'd be interested in a job like that, but not now, in the fall. She said, well, we're really looking for people. Could you just, like, come in? She said, we need, like, office help. I said, I'm not doing office help. I don't do that. But I would be interested in doing follow-up with the mentors. So, well, could you just come in for an interview? She spoke to Rabbi Gewirtz. He said, come in for an interview. So I came in, met with him. We clicked right away, and I started working 10 hours a week from home then. And in the fall, I started going in to the office a little bit. So that's how I started really professionally working. And I was I became a telephone mentor's mentor. So I didn't know all the answers, but I knew how to formulate some answers, how to give vocabulary to what people knew but didn't know how to articulate. Like, for instance, I'm learning Chumash and Rashi with my student. My student wants to know how Rashi knows that. So you know Rashi knows that, but how do you explain to your student that Rashi knows that? Right? So I'd help them figure out how to explain how we trust Rashi to know that. Or what book to learn next. At that time, I had pretty much, not anymore, but I pretty much had read most of the books that were published in English, most of the books that were in Nogea. At that time, they still were published slowly enough that I could read almost all of them today. Forget about it. It's out of control. Baruch Hashem. But I had my library, and I was able to guide people what book next, that kind of thing. And then sometimes I had to ask Shilas. I spoke to David Cohn, and I learned a lot through learning what I needed to know to answer the question. If I didn't know, somebody called me and asked me about Lilith. I didn't know about Lilith, but I did research, and I got back to them, and I learned about Lilith. So I learned a ton that way. Who's Lilith? Yeah, it's a whole interesting parsha. Not something, but she's a Nephila, maybe she was the first wife of Adam, and there's a whole big thing in the shade and all kinds of weird things about Lilith. Okay, so I had to learn about it. And meanwhile, the Reform Women's magazine is called Lilith. She's the hero of Reform Women because she's the one who went against Adam. It's a whole midrash. Anyway, so I learned a lot that way. So that's how I got into professional Kiruv, and then when we moved to Denver, it took a step up really in becoming a stronger teacher and growing that way. So I want to talk a little bit about how teaching transforms you. And really to go back to an experience that I had early in my marriage. When we first got married, I wanted to stay in Israel so badly, but my husband was in law school and he was learning American law, not Israeli law, and he couldn't make Aliyah with that. And so first we thought, well, maybe in 5 years, maybe in 10 years, and that didn't. And we knew that there was a risk that we wouldn't. And I also wanted somebody who would be in learning. Like, we weren't even like starting off our marriage with Kollel, so we weren't making Aliyah, and he wasn't going into Kollel. And I was like, well, we have to start our marriage off with a mitzvah. We can't just start. You know, like, you'll just go to work, and I'll just go to college, and we'll just be married. That's not okay. So something that I really cared about was Soviet Jews in Russia. So we decided that we're going to go to Russia on a mission. It was 1985, which was before the fall of the Berlin Wall and still communist Russia. And I was active in student struggle for Soviet Jewry on campus and lobbying congressmen and political activism in Manhattan. So we decided that's what we wanted to do. So we basically spent our wedding money on tickets to go to Russia and bring in supplies for refuseniks, memorizing names and people to meet. And so we spent 3 weeks in Russia. And at that time, in 1985, you know, I was 21 and influenced by college campus. And even though I was raised in America, I'm a 13th generation American, I was very influenced by what was going on campus and all the kind of pro-communist stuff. It's certainly pro-conspiracy, like, you know, the government's bad and it's conspiracy in America. And plus, I was influenced by my Zionist friends who said, you know, Russia, Rashaim, you know, and America, Amreka. Like, all Jews belong to Israel. America is nothing. And, you know, and then on campuses, all the Americas, like, you know, it's just a conspiracy and the government's, you know, no good and blah, 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 right? So I really wasn't in a highly respectful mode of America. At the time, I didn't appreciate what America was at that time. Went to Russia. I went to give. I went to start our marriage off on a mitzvah. But I was totally transformed by the visit. First of all, I came to love America. I never appreciated freedom of assembly and freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I never understood what the press was about, the whole concept of freedom of the press, not just that you can write what you want, but that the press is there as a check on society and on government and can expose things and research things and publish them and bring them to light. I never got that until I went to Russia and saw what Pravda looked like. Even in Russian, you could tell it's all lies. Pravda means truth. It's all lies. And it was amazing to me. I knew that an airliner went down, an Aeroflot airliner went down. It wasn't even reported. It just doesn't exist. If a plane crashes, the plane just never existed, and neither did the people in it. And when I got on an Aeroflot airplane, boy, did I appreciate American airplanes. I mean, they did have seatbelts, but the seats flopped back and forth. They give you bug juice in a melamine cup. You know, you don't have disposable cups. The stewardesses are big, fat ladies with big gold teeth, you know, and they're like, sit. And that's it. My husband's a round guy, and when we went to get our passport pictures taken right before the trip, so the passport photographer was a Russian. And he said, "Where are you going?" And we said, "We're going to Russia." He said, "You will like Russia. You will like Soviet Aeroflot, Soviet Airlines. Because next to Aeroflot, Soviet Airlines, stewardess, you are looking like skinny guy." And it was true. We got on the planes and we were shocked. And there's no oxygen. So no safety speech. It was scary. So but when I finished the trip, not only did we appreciate the wealth of America and the safety of American construction, buildings that work. I mean, there's a whole long line, which we saw around a corner. It was for ice cream. We weren't going to stand on it, but we were thirsty. We wanted a drink of water. There's a water machine there. You put in a Kopeck, and you get water. Put in two Kopecks, and you get a little Petel with your water, you know, the raspberry flavoring. So you step up to the machine, and you're thinking, okay, where's the cup? Like, do they have plastic cups or whatever, paper? No, they have a glass on top of the machine. You take the glass down, put your Kopeck in, drink it, and put the glass back on the top of the machine. So that was just one of the things that just helped me appreciate this country better. We did visit. We visited one family who was living in a communal housing unit. I mean, the way that poor families lived, one family per room. About the whole room was less than the size of this portion of carpet right here, in between the two stripes, about 2/3 the size for a family of four. I think there were 10 of those, so 10 families, a shared kitchen where everybody had a cabinet, and two to a stove. So it was a stove and two cabinets, a table, or you could have your table, you know, table for preparing things, so you ate in your room, and one bathroom, which did not have a shower. He showered somewhere else. It was just for all 10 families, with a stack of Pravda ripped up on the side. Fortunately, I had brought my own toilet paper. So anyway, I really learned to appreciate the freedoms of America, the wealth of America, the resources of America, and, again, the freedom of America. Here I'm visiting Jews that were stuck. That's the whole reason we were visiting them. They wanted to leave, and they couldn't. And the one who lived in that apartment, their apartment had been raided so many times because, you know, they taught Hebrew or whatever they did, whatever crime they committed. They were raided so often that when they took information, they just wrote it straight on the wall because you can't steal the wallpaper. Like, they couldn't come in and take the wallpaper off the wall. So if they needed to write a phone number or a name that they had to remember, they would just write it on the wall so that it couldn't be scooped up in a roundup. And I never appreciated what it's like to be able to walk free, breathe free. I was totally transformed. So that's the point that I want to make, is when you go to give, you get so much more. You get total transformation. When you're teaching Torah, you connect with it so much better, so much differently. People ask you questions that you might not have thought of on your own, or that you might not have had clarity to be able to explain in that way. The transformation inside you comes from your students asking you questions, comes from the growth that's brought about by the engagement with them. And that's what brings you to a higher place. It's not just your giving, which it is, the fact that you're giving, but the way they engage with you and brings out of you, develops you into the type of stronger, smarter, more connected to that you can become through that type of giving. I still have a partner in Torah. She's in Manhattan, a top doc in Manhattan. And we haven't learned for a while. We're on a little bit of break, but we're starting again on Sunday after a year's break. And it's an interesting relationship because she told me very clearly when we started, I am not becoming religious. I just want to make that clear. This is not about that. And I said, that's fine. She said, I just want to make it extremely clear. I'm not looking to become religious. I'm not planning on becoming religious. I just want to get that out in the open. I just want you to know there's no hope, so don't even try. I am not becoming religious. I said, that's fine. No problem. I just want to warn you, though, that it's possible that through the engagement, you might have some feelings that you might want to change your mind later on. So I just want to be honest with you, too, that, you know, Torah sometimes changes a person. So the story isn't that she became religious. So we both got our cards on the table there, and we learned regularly for an hour a week, every week, until her 50th birthday, when she said, I'm making a big party, and I want you to come. So I don't know if it's really in my price range, and she said, I'm flying you out. You're coming to the party. And it's Motzei Shabbos, so you'll stay with my friends in Borough Park first, you know, and then you'll be able to come to the party with them. So that's how I got to Borough Park for Shabbos. And that's how I got to this party. And once I got to the party, I realized, top doc, I had no clue. I didn't know the circle she traveled in. I didn't know the wealth that was there. I didn't know, like, everybody's like, oh, how do you know her? And, you know, there's people from top of the city all around the place. And I said, how do I know her? I learn with her. She learns? I said, yeah, we learned Torah for an hour a week. An hour a week? She spends an hour a week with you? You can't get an appointment for months with her. How does she spend an hour a week with you? And I'm like, well, she asked me, and so I do. And they couldn't believe that she had like a personal Torah teacher for an hour a week. But it was an interesting experience being there. And I learned a lot about politics and that Barack Obama is going to become the next president. She's very to the left. And she explained to me why he is going to be the man. And even though that's not who I voted for, so it was interesting to learn, you know, from the left-wing Democratic point of view. And so there's tons to learn through the partnership. While we were on a little bit of a break, I had another partner in Wyoming, a nurse. So that was just, there's so much in what we can learn from the partners that we have. I want to just talk about for a minute about what an hour in a life can do. Because I heard an interesting story, and I have two stories to share, just about the time that we can give. So we give an hour a week, and you never know what that hour can do for a person. I heard an interesting story at the Aish conference. I was just at the Aish conference where Rabbi Eric Coopersmith got up and talked about Rabbi Ephraim Shore. So Eric and Nehemiah Coopersmith, rabbis Eric and Nehemiah Coopersmith, and Rabbi Ephraim Shore run Aish, basically. They're the ones who keep it functioning. The website and honest reporting, they're like the koach at the top. They're not the fundraisers, but they're the make everything happen guys. So,
like brothers or something?
Eric and Nehemiah, excuse me, are brothers. So Rabbi Ephraim Shore was, I forgot his English name, Steve, you know, whatever he was, is still, he went off to Jerusalem in 1979 and found Eshet Torah, or found Rabbi Weinberg, and started studying with him. Meanwhile, he was the cousin of somebody, and Rabbi Eric Coopersmith got a letter. You know, Steve Shore, I forgot, it's not his right name, but is lost in a cult in Jerusalem. He's been captured, and he won't come home. And they have their clutches on him, and he's, you know, we have to figure out how to get him. So he knew that he's in a cult in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, he goes off now to Israel. He wants to be in kibbutz for a year. He goes to a Shomer Hatzair kibbutz, right? Shomer Hatzair is super left-wing, totally anti-religious. So that kibbutz, even in Yom Kippur, it's a regular day. That some kibbutzim Shomer Hatzair made like their annual pork barbecue on Yom Kippur. But this one didn't even do that. So, but he figured even at home, like he goes to the synagogue for a couple of hours, like he's going to take the bus into Jerusalem and just like spend Yom Kippur in Jerusalem. So he goes to Hebrew U and he finds his friends in Hebrew U, and his friends say, you know, we're going to go out. But first we're going to stop by, I don't think it was actually on Yom Kippur, maybe it was the day before. We're going to stop by our friend in yeshiva first, and then we're going to go out. So they stop by, and he meets this Shor kid. And as soon as they introduce him, he recognizes that's the name he got the letter about. This is the kid who's in the cult, who's stuck. So he tells him, go get your passport. I'll get you out now. We're going to make a break right now. I'll get you home. He's like, what are you talking about? I want to stay here. I want to be. He's like, come inside, see what it is. So he shows him around the yeshiva, and he sits in on a class. And he thinks, this is pretty interesting. There's a lot more about Judaism than I realized. Huh. And then he leaves, and he goes with his friends, and he goes back to kibbutz. And he says, you know, I have 10 days between the end of my kibbutz time and my ticket. I'm going to spend those 10 days at the end of the year in yeshiva. I think I should learn something more, right? But he has a Roman Catholic roommate there on the kibbutz who says, you know, all those rabbis are all fakes. You know, they're all telling you Judaism's great, and it's not. It's just as stupid as Catholicism. Trust me, I was in it. I know all those religious leaders. It's ridiculousness. Don't go back. So he's convinced, right? Okay, he's not going back. Meanwhile, after Sukkot, there's the little break, and the Shor kid's on the bus going to Tel Aviv, and he's on the road, and he passes the sign that's the name of that kibbutz. And he remembers he met Eric Coopersmith in yeshiva for an hour. And he said, you know what, I'm going to get off the bus and go look him up. So, you know, at that time, you could just, like, bring the local bus, bring the thing, get off on the road. He walks up the pathway into the kibbutz. He goes and finds Eric Coopersmith, and he didn't even know him. He met him once for an hour. He sat down, and he chatted with him, and he reconvinced him. He heard he's not planning on going, and he convinced him back that he should actually go. And he did, in the end, go, and now he's Rabbi Eric Coopersmith, and he runs Eishet Torah. And this is a total stranger who spent an hour, basically, just on a lark, got off the bus, and went to go see him. So you never know what could happen in an hour, what the seeds could be that you plant. I'll tell you one more story that really helped me. This could maybe be helpful for young mothers. I don't see so young mothers, but you can tell your friends who are young mothers, because this, for me, was very helpful. When I was a young mother, I heard Chedva Zilberfarb speak. So she was a young mother who unfortunately got very ill. She lived in Bnei Brak. She had three young children. And she came to America for treatments. And she was thinking to herself, like, she had a husband in Kollel. She's thinking, what mitzvahs can I do to generate merit for my recovery? So I don't have money, so I can't give tzedakah. And I don't have energy. I'm too sick, so I can't do chesed. What could I do, though? I could at least not speak Lashon Hara, because that doesn't take energy or money. So I could do that. And if I have any energy, I could tell women about this mitzvah of Shemiras HaLashon, and maybe they could guard their tongues. I think this is probably where it started, the Machsum Lafi, to guard your tongue for the sake of somebody, specifically, collectively. Maybe started with her. So she came, and she spoke about it, and she talked about how at night she'd be so she would be so sick that her neighbors, her friends, would take turns spending the night in her apartment because her kids were so young, they still woke up at night, but she couldn't get up for them. But her neighbors would take turns and spend the night in her apartment so they could get up for her children. And she used to hear her children cry and wake up and her friend go to her child, and she would daven and she'd say, please, Hashem, make me healthy so I could get up for my own children. Please, if you make me healthy enough that I could get up for my own children, I would never complain about getting up. I would dance to my children in the middle of the night if I had the schus to get up for them myself. So when I heard that, I was totally changed. I had baby twins at the time. So I had a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and baby twins. I hadn't really slept through the night for a while. And after that, every time they cried, I just threw off the covers and said, I am dancing to you. I am so thankful to be able to get up, tired as I am, on my own two legs and go take care of my own child. I am dancing to you. It was 1 hour in her life that she spent with us and completely changed the way that I parented, really, for the rest of all my getting up in the middle of the night days. I didn't lose the feeling. Okay, so now, how do we make sure that we're strong in our ability to reach out and share with others? Really, the way to do it is to draw on the three main qualities of a Jew that are embodied in the names of Jews. So what do we call Jews? You tell me. Yehudim. Bnei Yisrael. And Ivrim, right? Those are the three, basically. Ivri is the first one. Avraham and Sarah had Ivri. Ivri means other, the other side. We're Hebrews. We come from the other side. So first, it's geographically the other side, from the other side of the Jordan. But really, second, it's the other side of everything. We stand on the other side of the whole world. The first quality of the Jew is to be an Ivri, be able to stand against everything, completely alone, on the other side. And that's why a ger is really called Ben or Bat, Sarah and Avraham, because they have that quality too. They earned it by stepping apart from their family, stepping away from the rest of the world, and standing alone. They earned the title Ivri and the childhood, being the child of Avraham and Sarah. I told my kids that they could say Sarah Safteinu instead of Sarah Imenu. And when they were kids in school, they missed having from cousins. So there were a couple of other kids of Gerim in Benos Yaakov, where my daughters went to school. So they created a cousins club, because cousins share grandparents, right? So if Avraham and Sarah are the parents of their parents, so cousins share grandparents. So that means anybody who has a ger for a parent has the same grandparents, which means they're cousins. So they had a cousins club so that they could have some from cousins. So that's Ivri. That's number one, the ability to stand alone. Right? But stand alone is not enough. To be able to stand apart from everybody isn't enough. We need to know more than who we're not. We need to know who we are. Right? So it is important to know that we're not that. But who are we? So that's the second name. The second name is Yehudi. So Yehudi comes from the fourth son of Leah. Right? If there's four wives and 12 sons, so if you do the math, each one should have three. So, and Leah got children first. And the first three children were named after her pain. Reuven, because God sees my pain. Shimon, because God hears my pain. Levi, because God accompanies me in my pain. She was a woman feeling a lot of pain at being the less loved wife. But when she had the fourth, Yehuda, this time I'll thank Hashem. Not that she wasn't thankful for the other ones, but she said, this is an extra special simcha. This, I'll thank Hashem. And that's the first time that that Hashem was thanked in that way, Yehuda. And we are all named after that. So we're Yehuda, lahodot, means to thank and to admit that we are, really, if we would translate, we wouldn't be called Jews, which is after Judah, really, Yehuda, right? We'd be called thinkers, right? Because that's really who we are, the thinkers, right? So what we stand for is being in gratitude mode towards Hashem, that he runs the world, admitting that he's in charge of everything. And we're thankful for that. So we stand for recognition that God's in charge of everything. So that's what we aren't a part of. We stand against Ivri. What we stand for, thank and admit that Hashem runs everything. But one person alone can't change the planet. Even though there's a whole Eish HaTorah thing, one person can make a huge change, but they need people to go with them. So how does it work, one person alone? So we're not called the B'nai Avraham. And even though he went to Canaan with Kol HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Charan, where are all those nefeshes that he asa, you know, to mix up my Hebrew and English there? They're not recorded later on. They disappear. Right? Because there's not a community for them to be a part of. And we're not called the B'nai Yitzchak either, even though we are. Right? So what's with Yitzchak? So he also did his work, but he didn't transform the planet. It really takes a family. A family is the basis from which the planet can be transformed. A family that creates a community. That's why the family was large. 12 sons that created 12 shvatim that were the basis of a nation. It's working together, all of us, that we can be that rennet in the cheese of the world. One person can make a difference, but really as a community, that's when we're going to make a real difference. So we have to know who we're not, we have to know who we are, and we have to know who we stand with, who we're a part of. And it's only as a group that we can accomplish the whole planetary transformation mission that we're on as Jews. And that's why we need partners in Torah. We all have to reach out and find somebody who's not yet a part of the group. They're our brothers, they're our sisters, but they're not yet doing the thing that we all need to be doing together. Together we're going to change the whole world. We just have to get everybody on board so that together we can make a huge difference. So each one of us adds up to a piece of the community, it's the community together that will change. So I'll bless us all that in our individuality, we should have the strength to come into community, change the community, grow the community, and through that, change the entire world. So. And you can ask any questions if you want, or if you have to run home, you could do that too.